you've probably seen, today's lesson is about exploiting things that get between us and God. And this is kind of a philosophical lesson, so pull out your philosopher hat for this morning. We're going to debate the nature of humanity today. All right, so somebody could start off and read the first paragraph. That'll introduce the topic.
My dear Wormwood, I have been thinking very hard about the question in your last letter. If, as I have clearly shown, all cells are by their very nature in competition, and therefore the enemy's idea of love is a contradiction in terms, what becomes of my reiterated warning that he really loves the human vermin and desires their freedom and continued existence? I hope, my dear boy, that you have not shown my letters to anyone. Not that it matters, of course. Anyone could see that the appearance of hearsay into which I have fallen is purely accidental. By the way, I hope you understood, too, that some apparently uncomplimentary references to Slubbog were purely jocular. Really had the highest respect for him. And, of course, some things I said about not shielding you from the authorities was not seriously meant. You can trust me to look after your interests. But do keep everything under lock and key.
Okay. He talks a little bit about the idea of love and competition. So those are two things that people will dispute back and forth. And in fact, it goes back to the idea of whether God exists. The secular humanists tell us that everybody and everything, every species, is all in competition with one another. Survival of the fittest. And that not only goes from one species to the next, but also within each species. If you watch National Geographic and you see the lions out hunting in Africa, and you know, they'll take down a beast, and you know, sometimes they'll share the animal, but only if there's enough to go around. So other than that, it's whoever's the strongest is the one that gets the most to eat. So just looking at that would lead people to believe that humans are really no different, especially if you are strictly a humanist and you don't believe in God and you believe that everybody just evolved from lower forms of life and that that's all there is to the world, then that would stand to reason. So he says, if I've clearly shown all selves are by their very nature in competition, therefore the enemy's idea of love is a contradiction in terms. What he's saying is that love appears to be opposed to that idea, because the idea of competition means that in everything, if I gain, you lose, and that's the way life operates. So if there's something that I'm going to get, you're not going to get it. And so love is sort of the opposite of that. Love is, by its nature, self-sacrificing. There's only so much to go around, and so I'm going to share with you. You rarely see animals in the wild just getting a meal and then passing it around to all their friends. So it's a pretty rare thing. You do see it among humans. And that's one thing that sets us apart from animals. And what many of us see is evidence of our being created by God and being created as special and distinct from the animals around us, in that we have that sense of altruism, that we're willing to make sacrifices for other people that we don't see in other species. So before we go on, let's open that up to discussion. We can see evidence of both in our lives. You see definitely competition between human beings that sometimes resembles the National Geographic special. But we also see examples of love and compassion that it's very difficult for a strictly evolutionist to explain in evolutionary terms.
I picked up something else in here. I know I'm not on your on the subject if you want to, a point that you want to get onto. But I picked up something in here where he says, I hope that you understood too that some apparently uncomplimentary references to Slubdog were purely popular. We have a tendency, even within the church, we will make uncomplimentary references to some of our friends about someone else, and if they're received positively, where they join in, we go along with it. If we see them backing off and not agreeing with us, we back off and say, oh, I was just joking. You know, I was just kidding, and I really didn't mean that. I was just testing the water. But that's a human fault, frailty, I should say, in us all. That sometimes we'll make an uncomplimentary remark about someone to test the water, so to speak. If we find some allegiance in that, then we might continue on. If we don't, then we tend to back off and pass it off. I really wasn't serious. I was just kidding you. Yeah.
Otherwise, once there's blood in the water, then the feeding frenzy starts.
I'm
going to
bring I looked at the pot, which you said is a pot of Christians. We should not actually go act like the animals do. Mm-hmm. And we should have compassion for one another. Now, many of them in the world, not all of them, but many of them in the world who are not following the Lord, they see things a lot different. But I can get over on this one, I can get over on that one. I can use this one. That's the way they look at things. But we as Christians should not put ourselves in a situation where the laws are frowned upon us simply because we're not doing what he expects of us. We're supposed to uplift one another, help our fellow man, not necessarily all things, but just tell us to the church, do what we can. So that's one of the things I think that should stir us apart in those, many of those, in the world. Mm-hmm. Certainly, we are not lacking. Very well, I've been with the four people that said, well, you know, we animals too. I said, no, you better read your Bible. Because God is not an animal. He said he created us in his image. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that eliminates that animal stuff. And we act like it.
In terms of behavior, the way we would expect it to be is, here's the animals, here's humans in general, and here's Christians. So, does it work out that way?
I guess my question is, and I don't know the answer to this, is it something that's born in us or we're taught this? Because what pops into my mind was, you know, the other night we're watching a dumb criminal show, and I heard this story too, where these two girls saw these Girl Scouts out selling cookies, and the money was sitting on the table, and one of them just grabbed it and ran off with it. And then they came back and actually did an interview with TV, and one of the girls said, yeah, I know it was her money, but who doesn't like money? And it was just easy, and I wanted the money, so I just took it. She didn't have no remorse for what she'd done. And so I just wonder, is the first thing you think is, what did her mother teach her? It's usually the mother that people point to. Where's her mother in all of this? But you think about, too, some of the people who do really horrible things, like serial killers, and one time that they're at least, you know, born to that predisposition. As, you know, they say some people seem to be born without a conscience. And so I don't know. Is it something that is born into us, or is it something that we're taught growing up, or is it something that you have to have the germ of it inside you, at least, and then your parents bring that out of you? I don't know.
There's a gene for that.
You know, you can ask for it, too.
I think one of the biggest concepts that we have a hard time, especially as Christians, to understand, and I think it's from our education of creationism and evolution, and our identities are learned, genetic, and just reading these screw tape letters and things like that. We don't really, truly all the time grasp the fact that there are forces pulling us opposite of God. We believe in God as Christians, but rarely do we believe in the concept that there may be something swaying my emotions out of my control or pulling me in a direction other than God. Mm-hmm. Demons, devils, so on and so forth, so on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we rarely give that much validity when we get on this subject. Mm-hmm. But, in fact, if there is a God, and we believe in God and the Bible, we know that there is an opposite force that is pulling us and knows our every weakness, just like God knows our every weakness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it goes down to that understanding also. And we often are weak to that because we don't fully believe that all the way sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, we're dismayed as a crazy person talking sometimes, you know. If somebody mentions that a demon maybe do something. You know, so. But anyway.
That's true. They just kind of pay lip service to them. It's easy to believe in God. It's a little bit more difficult to believe in Satan and perhaps his followers. Something that's the other way. Okay.
One last point before you go. I like the last part of this letter here where he says, where basically he's saying, although I may have said some uncomplimentary things about his love job, mm-hmm. he says that you can trust me to look at it after your entrance. Mm-hmm. You can trust me. I won't say the same thing about you.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. The problem is whenever somebody talks bad about other people when they're around you, it really makes you wonder what they say about you whenever you're not around. Okay, he's going to explain in the next paragraph a little bit more about what he means about perhaps getting in trouble for some of the things that he's written. Somebody could read the next paragraph for us.
The truth is, I put by mere characters into saying that the enemy really loves you. That, of course, is an impossibility. He is one being. They have a sense in him. Their good cannot be his. All his talk about love must be a disguise for something else. He must have some real motive for creating them and taking so much trouble about them. The reason one comes to talk as if he really had this impossible love is our utter failure without that real motive. What does he stand to make out of it? That is a soluble question. I cannot see that it can do any harm to tell you that this very problem was the chief cause of our father's quarrel with him. When the creation of man was first moved, and when even that stage, the enemy freely confessed that he foresaw a certain episode about our talk. Our father very naturally sought an interview and asked for an explanation. The enemy gave no reply except to produce the cock and bull story about disinterested love, which he has been circulating ever since. This our father naturally could not accept. He implored the enemy to lay his card on the table and gave him every opportunity He admitted that he felt a real anxiety with the other people. The enemy replied, I wish with all my heart that he did. It was, I imagine, at this stage in the interview that our father's disgust at such an unprovoked lack of confidence caused him to remove himself an infinite distance from the presence which had given rise to the ridiculous enemy story that he was forcibly thrown out of heaven.
Okay, so the idea of being portrayed here goes back to the nature of man. The idea that if something is good for me, it must by definition be bad for you. And if something is good for you, it must by definition be bad for me, because we're all in competition with one another. So he extends this idea to our relationship between us and God. He says, God can't possibly really love us because he's a separate being than we are. So anything that's good for us must be bad for him. And so what he's showing here is that Satan doesn't truly understand or can't even comprehend the concept of love. Because if you were strictly a secular humanist, you would have a very difficult time with that concept. We often attribute the good things that we do to the fact that we're Christians. You know, you help somebody out when they're not expecting it, and we say we do that because we're Christians. The difficulty that some people have in understanding this concept is that people who are not Christians will do that too. Sometimes people who are not Christian also show compassion and thoughtfulness and love. And, you know, they love one another too, even though they're not Christian. Now, sometimes we look at that and have that call our faith into question. Well, you know, if God is the basis of love and Christianity is the basis of love, then how come those people who aren't Christians are doing good things too? But in reality, what this is saying is that God created human beings with a conscience and with the ability to love and to have compassion, not just Christians. He created humans with that capacity. Because a human who's not a Christian often just merely hasn't had the right circumstances yet to become a Christian, but everybody has that capacity in them. And that actually speaks for the existence of God. The fact that all human beings have, by their very nature, not only the drive for competition, but also the capacity for love and compassion. Yes?
Or does that blow somebody who's not a Christian's mind out? Not only are you taking care of yourself, you're not taking care of yourself, you're taking care of others, but those who do wrong against you, how can we do that? And that's a hard concept when you go out to the world and say, especially with the way the world is today, you love your enemy, they visit you, you still love them. That's a hard concept for, even at times for Christians to understand how far our love needs to go. How they know we're different, the way we love one another, the way we have love for others.
This is one of the most difficult things for atheists to explain, is this innate love that humans have and compassion that competes with that idea of competition. You know, a lot of other things are explainable. You know, you can describe how human beings came to exist perhaps through evolution, and you can explain the way the universe came to exist sometimes through natural processes and everything, although some of those tend to break down as you look closer. But you can wrap your brain around all that kind of thing because that's all kind of abstract. But when you see human beings doing things that are not in their own best interest, that flies in the face of Darwinian evolution because it shouldn't be that way. If we're just more highly evolved animals, we should still be in competition exclusively. Anything that's good for you must be bad for me. And so this is what C.S. Lewis is trying to describe here, the fact that Satan has a very difficult time with that concept. Just could not even comprehend the idea that God must not have some kind of an ulterior motive. He couldn't just simply love us enough to give up his Son on the cross. That's a hard concept for us to understand. If we think of sacrificing our child, not only for people who don't know about him, don't care about him, people that have been actively opposed to him at times, and yet we're going to give up our child for people that fall into that category. That's hard for us. Not many of us could make ourselves do that.
Yes. One of the things, many people need to understand the fact that the devil is simply here because he's trying to overthrow power. He's got to overthrow God. That wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. He can't happen.
Right.
The devil can't be the understanding thing how a father can give his only son. You know, sometimes it's hard for us to stand on that idea. What we know the Lord said about it, you know. And I'm real glad that he gave his life for us all. You know, and the devil may not be able to wrap his hand around that concept, because had he not been thrown from heaven, and if he had been the right type of angel, he should have been, he might have been still up there. And unfortunately, that's what he did. He didn't allow that. So, yeah, he came back as man around there. Because he would much rather us all get lost. That's his thing. Mm-hmm. That's the way he thinks.
I try to indulge my students when they ask why. Mm-hmm. You know, give them instructions, and every once in a while they say, well, why? Mm-hmm. And I remember growing up, it was because I felt that. There was no explanation. And many cases it was very confusing. It was like, you know, but why? So, and now that I'm a parent, I feel a little bit differently. I'm like, okay, if they ask why, explain it to them, because it's learning. And that way, I can explain to them why they can't do what they can't have, you know, as opposed to making them feel like they're just stuck. And I think that with this same situation, you know, God explained it, but he didn't give him the explanation that he wanted. Yeah. It wasn't good enough. And then to read on and see that the story has been flipped, it's like, wow, you know. Satan did it. It explains how, you know, when there's people in conflict, the stories are never the same. It's always, you know, there's three sides. There's each person's perception of what actually happened. So it's like, this happened here too. You know, kind of, I don't know, kind of makes you feel like, okay, I'm not so crazy. It happened there too.
And as you read this, don't forget that Satan is the father of lies. And so, as it said in the introduction to the book, which was many, many weeks ago as we were going through it, don't accept everything that Screwtape writes in here as the complete and utter truth, because he is a follower of Satan, and Satan is the father of lies. And so, you know, things from Screwtape's point of view, he either could be telling his lies or he's repeating the lies that Satan has been told in the context of these letters. Oh, I thought you said something. Okay. If somebody could read paragraph 2.
Since they have begun to succeed while our oppressor was so secretive, this throne depends on the secret. Members of this faction have frequently admitted that if ever you came to understand what he means by love, the war would be over and you should be into heaven. And there lies the great task. You know that he cannot really love. Nobody can. It doesn't make sense. If he could only find out what he is really up to, hypothesis after hypothesis has been tried, and still he cannot find out. Yet he must never lose faith. More and more complicated theories. Fuller and fuller collection of data, richer reward for research, truth makes progress, more and more trouble, terrible punishment for those who fail, all this pursuit and accelerated to the very end of time cannot surely fail to succeed.
Okay. This is just showing Screwtape's frustration at not being able to understand God's real motivation. Because if you reject out of hand the idea of love, of just pure unconditional love, then God's actions would be impossible to understand. So that's why he makes the comment that it had been said that if they did understand, they could re-enter heaven. Because if they did understand, they would understand, no, love is the correct answer. That it's not some great secret that God is keeping hidden from them, giving them a cover story, that this is the actual truth. And so if they could come to understand that, they would have nothing keeping them out of heaven at that point. Because if they could understand that to be the truth, they would realize that God wants everybody to be saved, and that he's provided the ability for everybody to be saved. But, of course, he gives us freedom of choice. He is what we're going to believe and what we're going to do. And we face the consequences of our decisions.
Dale, that goes back to the comment you made a while ago about sacrificial love, the love that the Father has for us. That even we cannot fully comprehend that. We want to. We've been told that. We read that. And we know that to completely have that embodied in us means throwing all of our faith on Him or in Him. But it's still unfathomable that a Father would give up His Son, not for just righteous people, but mm-hmm. for the murderers and the thieves and the crooks and the liars and whatever like that. Mm-hmm. We can't comprehend that. We strive to, but we don't fully comprehend it. And if we can't, in trying to, then Wormwood or Screwtape surely passes the by. It's just uncomprehendable to him.
What I was thinking about when you mentioned that just now, how the Lord gave his own son, and you know, so that was Abraham. That's why Abraham became, you know, the father of all the old people mm-hmm. and nations. He was willing to give his only son. But of course, you know, anger interjected that didn't allow him to give his son, but he was willing to do it. Mm-hmm. He was the only one that I know that I read by the scripture that he was willing to do mm-hmm. that other than God himself. Mm-hmm. So, anybody who has that kind of commitment and mindset, it's a great thing. I don't think there's many of us in here with children are willing to give them up.
It's interesting to read all the Old Testament stories and how they're all symbols and they're all in their own way a prophecy of what was to come.
Yeah.
You know, with Abraham being willing to sacrifice Isaac. And if you read carefully the text of the scripture, you realize he was doing that on the very mountain where Jesus was crucified. I didn't realize that at first until a little further study that was actually on the exact same hilltop as Jesus was going to be crucified. Okay. Alright, paragraph 3. We're going to apply this now to Wormwood's relationship with his patient. Here's where he's getting to the meat of the lesson. He's saying love in and of itself, and now he's talking about love between human beings. He says whether a human is in love or not in love, he said is really kind of irrelevant. And you can extend this to just about anything. Whether you do this or that, or whether you have this job, or whether you enjoy these activities, what Screwtape is writing here is that it really doesn't matter any of those things. What matters is the relationship that these things have on our relationship with God. So he's saying it really doesn't matter whether you're married or single or whether you're in a relationship or not in a relationship. In all those situations, you can still choose to follow God or you can choose not to follow God. He says what really matters is leveraging whatever situation it is. If the person enjoys a certain recreational activity, that isn't going to be the deciding factor on whether somebody is saved or not. What makes more of a difference is where is that in their list of priorities? What perspective does that person take on how they choose to spend their time? Because how we spend our time and money is one of the best indications of where our priorities are. And so if God ranks down here and all of our other activities fill our life, then that's kind of an indication of where our heart is and where we're placing our faith. And so what Screwtape is writing here is whether the person is single or married or in love or not in love or likes to skydive or likes to do whatever, use that to separate them from God. Use that to drive a wedge between them and God. Our perspective, on the other hand, is we have to fight against that temptation. Because whatever it is that we do and whatever it is we enjoy, we know Satan is going to want to use that to drive a wedge between us and God, and to try to separate us from God. God has promised nothing can separate us from Him that we don't choose. The key that we have to remember is that that doesn't mean nothing can come between us and God. It means if we don't want it to, God will make sure it doesn't happen. But He still gives us the freedom to choose. And if we place even our love for our spouse above our love for God, then Satan can use that to pull us away from God. And that puts us in a very difficult situation sometimes. If we have a spouse or a child or a friend or a mother or father, or aunt, uncle, grandparent that is not a Christian, and we're put in the situation where we have to choose between them or God, it can be a very difficult choice that people have to make. Somebody who's a living, breathing human that we interact with on a daily basis versus our belief in God that we don't actually see from day to day. So it's easy to sit here in Bible class and say, oh yes, we're going to pick God, when in reality our actions may tell a different story than what we're willing to say, because that's what the Bible class teacher expects you to say. Thoughts are coming. I'll read the last paragraph. I have to loose in.
If, on the other hand, he is emotional, gullible man, feed him on minor poets and fifth-rate novelists from the old school until you have made him believe that love is both irresistible and somehow intrinsically notorious. This belief is not much help, I grant you, in producing casual unchastity, but it is an terrible recipe for prolonged, noble, romantic, tragic adulteries, ending, far goes well, in murders and suicides. Failing that, it can be used to steer the patient into a useful marriage. For marriage, though the enemy's invention can be useless, there must be several young women in your patient's neighborhood who would render the Christian life intensely difficult, and if only you could persuade him to marry one of them. Please send me a report on this when you next write. In the meantime, get it quite clear in your own mind that this state of falling in love is not, in itself, necessarily favorable either to us or to the other side.
the simplification which we and the enemy are both trying to exploit. Like those of the other things which humans are excited about, such as health, sickness, age, and youth, the war, and peace, it is, from the point of view of the spiritual life, mainly raw material, affecting our people.
Okay. We do have a tendency to separate things into good or bad, or right and wrong, whether it's actions or things. This is a good thing, this is a bad thing. And marriage is one of those things. Everybody should grow up and get married. Sometimes that idea permeates our thinking. If somebody reaches the state of adulthood and they haven't gotten married, people tend to look at them sometimes and say, what's wrong with you? Why haven't you gotten married like everybody else? And that's what he's saying here, is that marriage in and of itself isn't a good thing or a bad thing. And this is from the demon's point of view. And the same is true from our point of view. What does the Bible say about marriage? It has some positive things to say and some other things to say about marriage. But what does it say about marriage?
Honorable.
Okay, it's an honorable institution. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. Okay. What else does the Bible have to say about it? Okay.
It's referred to as, if a man wants to truly serve God, better to burn. If you're going to burn with passion, you never will get married and live for God.
Okay.
I believe that's how you're going to live.
Yeah. All right.
Then you're confused.
Yes, baby.
Leave.
Okay. All right. The Bible has a lot to say about marriage. The main point is, this is the way God intended for most of us to live. This is the way that we keep the earth populated and everything, is through the idea of marriage and family and children and all that. But Paul also writes and recognizes that some people would prefer not to get married. And so Paul says, that's okay. You can make that decision. He says, that's not everybody's gift. But he said, the rules still apply to you about staying away from sinful activities. And he says, most people can't do that. Most people can't stay celibate. And so that's why the Bible recommends for most people that they get married, so that they can satisfy their earthly lusts without committing sinful acts. But he says, Paul says, for some people, they can live that way. Paul says, I have the ability to stay single and serve the Lord 100% of the time. And he says, that's okay. That works for me. He says, I recognize that doesn't work for everybody. So he says, he says, there's nothing wrong with getting married and there's nothing wrong with staying single. He says, what matters is whether or not you serve the Lord, in whatever state you happen to be in.
But there's caveat to that too, to not be yoked to an unbeliever.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not saying just go out and pick the person that you... I won't use the word fall in love, but you're infatuated with.
Right.
You need to choose wisely because you shouldn't be yoked to an unbeliever. And when you do this, it's for life.
Right. And so the Bible and Screwtape approach this from the opposite side. Screwtape says there are lots of people that your patient could be married to that is going to be very bad for their relationship with God. So he says, encourage that. Whereas God says, there are lots of people you could be married to that are going to interfere with your relationship with me. So don't marry them. That's the only difference between the statements. And in this fact, Screwtape and God are in complete agreement. They said there are marriages that are going to help you draw closer to God, and there are marriages that are going to separate you from God. So Screwtape votes for one, and God votes for the other.
I think an underlying point that Screwtape is putting across here is that whatever... Yeah, the enemy's goals are, whether they be noble or some ignoble, we can take advantage of them. All we got to do is watch them and take advantage where they have a weak point. They may want to achieve a noble goal, But if after they achieve it, then they aren't doing it in God's way or the enemy's way, then there's an open cross.
Mm-hmm.
We can get them.
That is true. That is, and there are things that are openings for Satan, and there's things that are opening for us if we're trying to serve God. Up to each side to watch for those openings. And it's easy for us to rationalize to other people why we do things. Why we're getting married, why we're not getting married, why we're in a relationship or why we're not. But we know the truth and God knows the truth. And so we can rationalize all we want about why we think we should marry this person, even though everybody thinks it's a bad idea. Or why we shouldn't marry them, although everybody thinks it's a good idea. But we and God know the answer to that question deep down, our gut feeling. Sometimes we know we're marrying this person for the right reasons or for the wrong reasons. But what matters is how it affects our spiritual relationship and nothing else. It doesn't matter nearly so much about the person's level of physical attractiveness or whether this person is fun to be around. This person can be the most enjoyable person we'll ever meet, but if they're going to come between you and God, then we need to think twice. We need to do more than think twice. We need to let that affect our decision making. It's difficult when you're single and when you're lonely. And sometimes Satan can use that to leverage us, like Jerry was talking about, into saying, you know, I'd rather be married than to be single and lonely, even if this marriage isn't perfect. And when we say not perfect, we mean terrible. Sometimes no marriage is perfect, but some we can tell are doomed from the start. And we'll blind ourselves to that fact because we don't like being lonely. Satan is looking for ways to take whatever we do and to create a gap between us and God. He'll take the smallest little fissure and start driving the wedge into it to try to separate us. And God is constantly trying to build those bridges and let us come back. And this is spiritual warfare that's going on every day, and we're the ones caught in the middle. We're the ones that are the frontline soldiers fighting this fight and making the decisions about what we're going to do. So we just need to keep thinking about what Satan's viewpoint is and what God's viewpoint is each time and each of those hundreds of decisions we make each day. Final thoughts to come. John, could you close us in prayer?